in a bung in a dormitory.
SpongeBob Hemp.
Disgusting and green and sticky as he.
SpongeBob Hemp.
Smoking the chronic is something you do.
SpongeBob Hemp.
Put your thumb on the cob and he'll smoke it with you.
SpongeBob Hemp.
SpongeBob Hemp.
SpongeBob Hemp.
SpongeBob Hemp.
You know, Hash Prick, I can't think of anything better than hanging out with my best friend and playing Tony Hawk Pro Skater.
I know one thing that could make it better.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I think I am.
Then I'll just roll up a big fat... Oh, no!
What's wrong, SpongeBob?
We're out of seaweed!
No!
Yeah. Now you understand.
Give me a ball.
Cannabis defeat. Cannabis defeat.
That's hella fresh. Ah, one love.
My name is Scooter, and you're listening to The Inner Side, produced at Scooter Built Studios, situated on the Gulf Coast of the Lone Star State, home of Yankee Rust Belt trailer trash and Connecticut carpetbaggers. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard the case for medical marijuana and defeated it in a rather swift and judicious proceeding. What's up with that? Well, I had my own theory on that subject. Hold on a minute. I'll check this out. Hold on. It's not like we live in an oligarchy, which purchases the best democracy money can buy. Palace stole that from me, you know. And since this country doesn't produce anything but guns, propaganda, and global terror, we're reduced all the way down to a bare-bones consumer economy, which means you have to keep the money circulating and running around in circles, where it eventually ends up down at Walmart, buying electronics, the Miracle Mile, buying automobiles, and eventually the legal system, buying defense lawyers, and the end game, the newly privatized prison industrial complex, all of which sums up as gross national product. Hold on a minute. Let me put some music on here. I'll be right with you. Now, I don't believe we live in some... Hold on a minute. Now, I don't believe we live in some oligarchy masquerading as a republic where the ruling class is calling the shots. That's just, you know, lefty propaganda stuff. But if it were true, it seems like it would be in the best interest of the overclass to keep those black market prices as high as possible and keep that consumer economy stoked. You know what I mean? Hold on a minute. I mean, I was reading this thing the other day by Catherine Austin Fitz about how the dope market keeps Wall Street floating because Wall Street's the easiest laundry on the planet, which really blew my mind. I mean, so on that note, I'd like to, why don't we just call up Catherine? Let's call up Catherine and see what she says. Hi, Catherine, it's Scooter. I wanted to sort of delve into some of the conflicts of interest that would come in the ending of the drug war. And I just read your Narco Dollars for Beginners, which is at narconews.com?
Yes, that's okay. Correct.
And now mostly what you speak about in there is the import trade of the harder drugs, which is a little bit different than marijuana. But before we talk about marijuana, why don't you sort of give us a real quick primer of how the drug economy interacts with the so-called legitimate economy?
Well, the narcotics trafficking for the last 50 years has been a very big and high-margin business. And what I describe in Narcodolish to Beginners is the extent to which we have found ways, with the help of government and large corporations, to run those revenues through publicly traded companies, so that the profits of this high margin business are leveraged in the stock market, generating a very low cost of capital for corporations, and engineering a process which I describe as neighborhood leverage buyouts, where large corporations can take over the market share, the retail market share in a neighborhood, by bringing drugs in and financing their control of the marketplace with money coming out of that neighborhood.
Now, let me ask you something. The first time that I became aware that money was being laundered through Wall Street was from Michael Rupert, whom you know, and who, by the way, scooped Gary Webb by I don't know how many years. But I was a little bit unclear. I can't go to the New York Stock Exchange with just a suitcase full of 20s and buy stock, or can I? Mean, how does don't you have to still launder it first?
Well, there are many different ways. A perfect example is I've written a story called The Real Deal on RJR Nabisco, which is a story that describes the European Union lawsuit brought against RJR. And if you read the story, which you can link to from my website, or just do a search for my name, Catherine Austin Fitz and RJR, what you'll do is you will pick up, you can link to the legal complaint filed in the Eastern District of New York by the European Union on behalf of 10 or 11 sovereign nations of Europe, Sweden, France, Germany. These are countries that have extraordinary intelligence and military intelligence capacity. And it's a 200-page document, Scooter, that's more fun to read than Tom Clancy, because it describes, you know, a whole series of different money laundering schemes engaged in by one of the largest corporations in America and one of the most prestigious corporations around the world to engage for decades in significant business relationships with the Colombian mafia, the Italian mafia, Saddam Hussein's family, the Russian mafia, doing billions of dollars of money laundering using cigarette sales. Now, those are, you know, money laundering's like the joy of cooking. There's thousands of recipes in the joy of cooking. So if you understand sort of all the recipes for corn, you don't necessarily know all the recipes. But it's a wonderful primer on how money laundering is done. And when I read it, and it describes this in my article, I was an investment banker on Wall Street, and my firm was the lead investment banker to RJR Nabisco, which was sold in a leveraged buyout in 1989. So it became a very famous movie and book called Barbarians at the Gate. And I could never figure out, Scooter, how can they afford to pay this much money for this company? It doesn't make sense. And after I read the European Union's law complaint, I realized, oh, now it makes sense, because they were pumping through huge illegal revenues, and that's what was holding their stock up. If you read the European Union's lawsuit and you just assume that half of their allegations are true, what you realize was without those, you know, illicit revenues, RJR Nabisco's stock would have been in the tank. And we did an audio seminar, and you can link to it from my website, called Narcodollars for Beginners, and I link to a list of all the sort of the best resources in the world to help the, you know, somebody who knows nothing about how this works come to understand the extent to which the legal economy is now owned and controlled by the people doing this. We watched during the explosion of Iran-Contra financial fraud during the 80s, we watched the media get bought up, and as that consolidation of media occurred, and the dependency of the remaining media on military satellites and, you know, sort of these global operations that are very dependent on centralized government and centralized military, what happened was, you just saw less and less information about what was really going on. And so, you know, when people always say to me, well, how come if this is going on, I don't know about it? You don't know about it because essentially the people dealing drugs in your neighborhood are, you know, financing and buying up the TVs that you're watching. So you know, if you look at who out now owns, a friend of mine used to work for as a special assistant to one of the chairmen of one of the biggest media companies in the world. And they used to bring the evening news headlines into him, and he'd edit and cancel them. So basically, you've got the stock investors and what's important to the stock investors driving the news, and the news is being, you know, sort of scripted to be for what's good for the investors, and the investors are the people who have the money. And over the last 500 years, if you look at who ends up with all the money, it's the people who do the high-margin businesses, which more often than not are, you know, involves either illegality or rigging government to do something that is has a very high margin, such as war.
Okay, if we were successful in either drug interdiction, which is impossible, but, I mean, let's just say, you know, in a fantasy world that we could actually...
No, it's very possible. We could easily be successful in drug interdiction. The theory that things aren't working because it's too hard to do and we can't do it or we're all somehow incompetent, that's a myth. If we spend $400 or $450 billion a year for military, and one myth says that not a nanospeck of missile can cross our borders without us knowing and, you know, being Johnny on the spot, but somehow that same capacity, which can surveil every inch, you know, from a satellite, know everything that's going on, can't stop oodles and oodles of truckloads and boatloads of cocaine. I mean, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
You know, this is kind of what you're saying is kind of reminiscent of a story that Mike Levine, you know who Mike Levine is, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Tells for the listeners, he's a very, very highly decorated retired DEA agent.
Uh-huh.
And during George the First, there was an operation called Operation Snowblind, I believe it. I think it was Bolivia.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, you know, all these paramilitaries and, you know, Dine Corps guys and military guys. They're stomping all around in the jungles of Bolivia. Meanwhile, they got a runway for a 747 that they couldn't seem to find, you know?
Well, I mean, when you think about it, all the bank wires batch and go through the New York Fed. You know, don't tell me we don't know where the money's coming from and where it's going. I mean, this is pretty simple.
Well, let me ask you, I guess, the big question, and that is, if we could do drug interdiction, or if the drug trade would be subterfuged or whatever by legalization, what would happen to the economy and to Wall Street?
If you come to my county, the biggest businesses are selling drugs, whether legal or illegal. We have a psychiatric hospital for people after, you know, we finish selling them drugs. They have nervous breakdowns, and so then we go, you know, counsel them. We have a big sheriff and all sorts of police and trooper operations, and then the courthouse, and then we have all sorts of rehabilitation and doctors and stuff like that, and then we have big prisons, big CCA prisons. So basically, you know, are the biggest source of making money and employment in my county is sort of a kinder, gentler kind of Holocaust where we liquidate our neighbors, particularly our neighbors' children. Let's say tomorrow we legalized and did nothing else. Then it's fair to say that we could get a pretty significant drop in the economy. I mean, what this all comes down to is you have interests which now hold a lot of the profits that they've made from the last 50 years of drug dealing. And so the question is, they now have a whole bunch of cash and we need to borrow money, and how are you going to resolve that relationship? So let's say if you resolve that relationship successfully to our favor, it's possible to re-engineer the economy to be fine. If you don't deal with or re-engineer that relationship to our advantage, then you could have a real crash. So facing this or dealing with it means that we have to start facing who's been doing this and how does the money work behind the governmental mechanism. Because this will all take you back to the big banks and their management of treasury, and that credit mechanism. And so if you want to withdraw our society from our addiction to narcotics trafficking, then you have to sit in the middle of the U.S. Treasury and you have to be prepared to re-engineer the capital flows of the federal government and the federal budget.
Okay, let's sort of move into marijuana, which is significantly different economy.
Yes.
Because it's in part, it's more of a cottage industry kind of thing. I don't think that there's a lot of real heavies. I mean, there's a lot of stuff coming up from Mexico, but I think it's still mostly
from what I've read, and I don't know if the statistics that I'm reading are accurate. It's hard to get statistics that you can be clear or really accurate. But from what I've read, we're much more of a producer than an importer.
Right.
So for U.S. farmers, marijuana is much more of a cash crop domestically.
You wouldn't know that by smoking any of the dope around here, though.
Well, it's funny because I remember reading one report saying that the number one cash crop in Tennessee where I live is marijuana. And I kept saying, I don't see it. Where is it? I drive around. I don't see it.
Oh, it's becoming clear. They're growing pot along the railroad tracks in Tennessee and shipping it to Houston and overcharging.
Statistics, I'm surrounded by marijuana that I can't see.
You're listening to The Inner Side. We're talking to Catherine Austin Fitz, and hold on a second. No, I mean, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, in my experience, when I was on Wall Street and when I was an investment banker in Washington, I could never understand why everybody was talking about drugs because drugs, as a financial matter, are a very insignificant portion of total money laundering and financial fraud.
Right.
In other words, I can make more money, doing insider trading in the commodities markets, in the derivative markets than I can, in a day or a week than I can in narcotics trafficking in a year. So I could never understand why everyone kept talking about, why it was so important. Scooter, is this connection okay? I keep hearing a funny noise.
It's cool when the kids are running the microwave and it kind of interferes. Go ahead.
It took me many years to understand that narcotics trafficking has been basically the train tracks that has been used to build social and political control place by place. All political power and economic power comes from controlling places. And so that power has been built through drugs, but more importantly through the war on drugs. And so, the drugs financed and the war on drugs financed or created the authority for a whole infrastructure of laws and enforcement and court capacity that over time has really exercised massive political control over places. And part of the targeting of the Afro-American population is to really make it easier to engineer control of the budgets and the political process in what is supposed to be a democracy. And so the drugs and the war on drugs have really been the train tracks used to take political control of places covertly and to build a fascist governance structure.
Right. Yeah, you're right. The war on drugs is like the...
Scooter, are you okay?
No, yeah, I'm fine.
You like, seem a little...
It's like the foundation for the Patriot Act.
Right, the Patriot Act has been evolved through the war on drugs. And if you read... It's hard to see this unless you're
but Catherine, I remember this whole debate, when it was going down in the Congress and you had Orrin Hatch and, John Ashcroft and who's the vice president guy?
Dick Cheney.
Right. And they're all saying, hey, look, man, we need to have the same kind of powers against terrorists as we already have against drug dealers. I mean, they tore up the Constitution and wiped their butts with it, way before this stuff, way before 911.
I find it's easier to understand these things when you look at stories. And that's why the story of Dylan Reed, and I just happened to know it because I worked there, and I was a partner at Dylan Reed and on the board. I mean, here you have Dylan Reed making money, from fees, doing business from RJR, who, according to the European Union, is running one of the biggest global money laundering syndicates, or a huge global money laundering syndicate on a very intentional basis. They're taking that money and investing. In 1990, they banked Cornell Corrections, which was a prison company, took it public in 1996. And so here you have people making money from the real criminality who are, helping RJR help the Colombian mob bring the money into neighborhoods, taking their profits and turning around and, building prisons to house, the children who've been targeted with all these activities. So you have the real criminals essentially running a depopulation operation. If you step back and look at it, it's pretty clear what it is and how it works. It's just very hard for most of us to sit back and say, we're really doing this.
You've been listening to...
Catherine Austin Fitz.
I was just going to say that. Oh, all right. On the Inner Side, we've been talking about the thing that went down with the Supreme Court about medical
marijuana.
That's right. And the potential relationship with
the legitimate economy.
Oh, thank you, Catherine. Anyway, we gotta let you go, so see you later, and thank you very much for being a guest, and
Stay tuned.
We have been told that we have been polled.
There is a very serious threat.
And we do so boldly, all agree.
Another incident. If we don't, terrorism
those suspected could have been
civil liberties. Well,
we are to henceforth submit ourselves to an indefinite
type of enforcement tools as organized crime.
Paternalistic.
The same tools.
Wartime.
That we use against society.
Not easily reversible.
Of drugs pushers and
the task force.
Children.
Cannot reverse themselves because of a petition. An indefinite institutionalized
a serious threat
wartime jurist
task force.
John Ashcraft recalled the 80s when the U.S. declared its first war on itself. Congress was forced to deal with President Reagan's Latin American liberation movement several times. In 1987, the flood of Reagan cocaine had precipitated the crack epidemic. This epidemic had crested and was fading when the U.S. Congress decided it was time to do something about it.
Currently, cocaine traffic is a variable in geopolitical militarism, where any opposition to a generalissimo government might disappear in the flames fanned by the U.S. security forces heavily involved in trafficking and prevention. In the pre-Columbian drug war theater, most of the damages were domestic.
Another peculiar institution here in these United States.
Christine Johnson, a friend of Leroy Williams, sentenced for 13 years on drug conspiracy charges. There was no drugs found in our home.
Being people in their proper place.
Brother's wife, he's serving 13 years for conspiracy.
Fulfilling their historic role. And if they don't like that place, then these people can be accommodated in one of the newly constructed places built for just that purpose.
But my brother is waiting to be sentenced on conspiracy charges. He wasn't even searched, no drugs found.
In a very targets once again with a lot of families.
I have four brothers incarcerated for conspiracy.
Families. Control.
No, our jail population is larger than five of our states.
Daddy?
And just take a young man's life away like that. 23 years old. Take his whole life away from him for something that.
We had a lock on this railway to kids.
control.
Next week, requiring telephone companies to give law enforcement agencies additional wiretapping.
To fight terrorism and foreign...
The drug war may have actually worsened whatever actual drug problem there was here, but now there's a system within the system that functions untethered by the Bill of Rights or any protections. Since then, the architects of this emerging police state with records of hostility towards any civil liberty they don't use, like Orrin Hatch and John Ashcroft, have been working hard to pull the rest of the court system in through this enormous hole that virtually every discussion of individual rights is loaded with references to drug pushers and organized crime and... This war that is to be fought with finances and diplomats and...
Bush spent the day looking for more friends.
Companies and intelligence.
Reporters with Mr. Bush at the CIA this week. The agency's terror spokesman said they're pinning one on Osama bin Laden.
Against people we can't see, in which country we're not sure.
Our weapons are military and diplomatic, financial and legal. And in this struggle, our greatest advantages are the patience and resolve of the American people.
It's going to be fought with more law enforcement, asset seizure, informers, phone taps, and all the blank search warrant, corruptions, informants, bribery, misinformation, open-ended clauses, and widely applicable decrees.
There may be in the country suspected foreign plans. They could have been any. And we think that...
They want to fight this battle where there are no rules of evidence, no need for corroborating testimony, a wide-open conspiracy ruling, convictions on hearsay, convictions based on intent instead of deeds,
powers that may
be coerced or purchased by the state with cash money. This is where they like to operate, outside the Constitution, in this territory established by drug war hysteria. And that is why grown men who are addressing the essential matter of individual liberties during a national emergency keep talking about drug dealers.
We have the same that we do for drug dealers.
The same tools that we use against society.
Bastards or surveil them that we do for drug crimes.
Exploiters of drug pushing presidents' children.
And for organized drug crime.
Drug lords or things like drug crimes and sex lords.
Airtight surveillance.
And things like the children's mafia.
That we do for drug dealers.
Well, how many people you got in detention would
helping
you put
White
in that
House or helping General Ashcroft? That's what the president has asked for. We've got to get the mafia back into the hands of the president. That's what John Ashcroft has asked for. I think if we don't get this done so that we can electronically surveil the American people, and I think we've got to find ourselves in another incident. If we don't do it, we could cause another. We risk the whole country, or at least have an incident that could cost our very, very dear parts. They will get
all
the tools necessary to be able to do a much better job.
I'm sorry, gentlemen. I must end it at that point.
There are people in detention, terrorists, and spies. But I call upon the Congress. To act quickly.
You've been listening to a 2001 mix by yours truly. Before that was a real live interview with the brilliant, a really good sport, an extremely dangerous Catherine Austin Fitz. That's definitely somebody you want to keep an eye on. She spells her name Catherine with a C, Austin like the capital of Texas, Fitz, F-I-T-T-S. So just Google that and check it out. My name is Scooter. You've been listening to The Inner Side. See y'all next week.
You know, if you step back and look at it, it's pretty clear what it is and how it works. It's just very hard for most of us to sit back and say, you know, we're really doing this.